Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, The Doctrine of Man, Part 12. For more resources from Dr. Craig, go online to reasonablefaith.org.
In our lesson, we've been talking about the doctrine of sin, and particularly the doctrine of the fall of man. And last week, we looked at challenges to the existence of the historical Adam. And of course, if there was no historical Adam, then there was no historical fall. So the fall, as a doctrine, stands or falls with the historicity of Adam and Eve. And we saw that the historicity of Adam and Eve have a significant challenge today from population genetics. The best argument against the historicity of an original human pair is fairly simple to understand. It is that the genetic diversity that is exhibited by the human population on Earth today is so broad that it couldn't have originated from two original people. The diversity in the population of the Earth today is such that it would have required a minimum population of a few thousand or so. And therefore, given the genetic diversity that we see today on this planet, it's argued that there could not have been an original human pair from whom the human race descended. And last time I looked at some challenges to this. It is predicated upon mathematical models that assume the mutation rate is constant over time and that genetic diversity is not subject to natural selection. And we saw, at least in one example on the sub-Antarctic archipelago, that these models yielded false predictions with regard to the sheep population on that island, that the amount of genetic diversity exhibited by the present-day population of sheep would have seemed to require, given these models, a much larger initial population. But in fact, we know that it was only two original sheep that were introduced onto that island in 1957. So it seems that the person who believes in the historical Adam can challenge the assumptions that underlie these mathematical models. And calling into question these estimates of the size of the ancestral population is not without precedent. For example, back in the 1990s, the evolutionary biologist Francisco Ayala, very prominent evolutionary biologist, attempted to estimate the ancestral population size based upon a present-day genetic diversity in a portion of the human genome involving what are called HLA genes, and that's how you spell Ayala's name. Assuming a constant mutation rate and a lack of natural selection for genetic change, Ayala arrived at an estimate that there must have been at least 32 separate versions of these HLA genes at the time of our last common ancestor with chimpanzees. So before the tree of primate evolution broke into separate branches for chimpanzees and human beings, there must have been enough of a population size to carry these 32 separate versions of these HLA genes. Indeed, Ayala estimated that that population size must have been around 4,000 individuals at a minimum. And that would obviously be incompatible with the origin of the human race from an ancestral pair. It turns out, however, that these assumptions that Ayala made were very likely false for HLA genes. Subsequent estimates, which have corrected for those assumptions, yield a number of different versions of the HLA gene to be not 32, but only 5. And of those 5, only 3 were ancestral, primary, before chimps and human beings diverged on the tree of human evolution. So the last common ancestor may have carried only 3 different versions of the HLA gene, and that could have been easily transmitted by an original human pair to the present-day population with the HLA diversity in the human genome that is exhibited today. And so I'm told that Ayala's original estimates of human population size based upon HLA genes is now obsolete. This is no longer offered as part of the evidence for the size of the ancestral human population because it's simply been shown to be predicated on false assumptions, and therefore no one appeals to it today. It's of historical interest only. But that historical interest, I think, is important because what it shows us is that calling into question some of the assumptions underlying these mathematical models is not without precedent, that there is precedent for thinking that these assumptions may be false and that therefore these estimates of minimum population size may well be incorrect. So I think that the person who wants to defend the historicity of an ancestral human pair for the human population is rational in doing so. His view is tenable in light of population genetics, and that therefore the doctrine of the human fall into sin is not ruled out by such studies. Now, before we proceed, is there any comment or question that anyone would like to raise about that issue? Yes, David. Now, we've got a microphone here, David, so let us wait until we get that to you so all can hear.
It seems as though when you read the biblical account of Adam and Eve, that God created Adam fully grown.
Yes.
As opposed to evolving from some previous primate or animal or being.
That issue wouldn't be relevant to the question of the challenge of genetic diversity to the original human pair. Why is that? Well, even if Adam and Eve were special creations by God, unrelated to previous hominid forms like Homo erectus and Homo habilis and so forth, the question would still be, how could present-day genetic diversity arise from that original human pair? In fact, it occurred to me talking to someone last week after class that this challenge is even worse for the special creationist, because the young earth creationist has to say that this genetic diversity has evolved within only about 10 to 20,000 years, whereas the progressive creationist can say that the creation of human beings took place around 150,000 years ago, and therefore that gives some scope for the evolution of genetic diversity. So this challenge is actually worse, I think, for the young earther who thinks that Adam and Eve were special creations by God at most 20,000 years ago. He's really then going to be hard-pressed to explain how this much genetic diversity could be exhibited by present-day humans. So I don't think that we need to enter into debates over whether or not Adam and Eve were the result of special creation or guided evolution or whatever. The challenge to the historicity of Adam and Eve from population genetics is really quite independent of their origin. Yes, Tom?
How critical is this issue to the overall sort of Christian worldview? I know you've talked about that web where there are certain critical things in the center.
Yes.
And then there are other things around the edges. Where does this fit in the whole scheme of things?
That forms a very nice segue, Tom, to the next portion of the lesson that I'm going to give. But let me highlight what Tom has said, because I do think this is important. I think that our Christian worldview can be thought of as like a web of beliefs, kind of like a spider's web. And beliefs that are near the center will be more deeply ingrained than beliefs that are at the periphery of the web. If you pull one of the strands that is out at the periphery of the web, that will cause some minor reverberations in the web, but it won't cause the web to collapse. On the other hand, if you pull out some of these central beliefs in your web of beliefs, that's going to send reverberations throughout the rest of the structure, will cause significant revisions, maybe even collapse of the web of beliefs. So what are some of these central doctrines that lie near the core of the Christian web of beliefs? Well, certainly things like the existence of God would be one of these core beliefs. If you pull that out, Christianity is toast. You can't have Christianity that's atheistic. I think the deity of Christ would be one such core belief. His resurrection from the dead, human sinfulness, and hence need of redemption. These would be central doctrines that could not be easily given up without really destroying the Christian doctrine. By contrast, doctrines like the rapture of the church or the tribulation, modes of baptism, infant baptism versus adult believers' baptism. Even I would say doctrines like predestination would be more at the fringes of the web of beliefs. You could would give those up, and it would cause you to have to revise your beliefs, but they wouldn't be devastating. Indeed, there are many Christians who don't hold to those same beliefs that you might with regard to these more peripheral doctrines. So the question is, where does the doctrine of the fall stand with respect to this web of beliefs? How deeply ingrained in the web of Christian beliefs is this doctrine? Does it lie somewhere near the center or closer to the periphery? Now, I'll say something about that in just a moment, but since you're only the second person to get to ask a question, let me just see if there are others that have a comment before we move on to addressing Tom's issue. It appears not, so that is a nice segue. Thank you, Tom. So I've argued that the traditional doctrine of the fall is defensible in light of modern population genetics. Still, it's worth asking, I think, what would happen in the worst case scenario that belief in a historical Adam is no longer tenable. If we've got to give up belief in the historical Adam and Eve, how significant would that be for the Christian faith? Well, clearly, as I said, if you give up belief in the historical Adam, then the doctrine of the fall goes out the window. You couldn't have a historical fall if there wasn't a historical Adam. So the doctrine of the fall would be lost if the historicity of Adam and Eve were to be abandoned. Now, that would in no way imply that the historical fall would be necessary to man's being sinful and in need of God's forgiveness. The fact that there wasn't a historical fall wouldn't do anything to deny the fact that all people are fallen and sinful and therefore need God's forgiveness and redemption. You don't need to have a historical fall in order to affirm that all people are lost and in need of salvation. So the doctrine of the fall isn't essential to the doctrine of the universality of sin and the need of salvation. On the other hand, it does seem that the doctrine of the historical fall is essential to the doctrine of original sin. There's no way that all people can be implicated in Adam's sin if, in fact, Adam never existed. So that the doctrine of original sin, I think, could not survive the abandonment of the historicity of Adam and Eve. Now, that raises then the further question, can Christianity survive without the doctrine of original sin? And we know the answer to that question, and the answer is yes, because although the doctrine of original sin is part of Catholic and for the most part Protestant doctrine, the Eastern Orthodox churches like Russian, Greek, Syrian, Slavic Orthodox churches do not in fact hold to the doctrine of original sin. Now these Orthodox confessions believe in the historicity of Adam. They do accept that Adam and Eve existed, but they see Adam merely as the portal through which sin entered into the human race. Through the deception of Adam by Satan, sin entered into the human race and then spreads to all people. But Eastern Orthodoxy does not believe that we are implicated for Adam's sin, or that we are somehow culpable for what Adam did. Neither, by the way, does Judaism believe this. This is not part of traditional Orthodox Judaism, that we are implicated in and culpable for Adam's sin. So while the abandonment of the doctrine of original sin would have major theological consequences for Catholics and for most Protestants, such a move would not faze Orthodox Christians. Cornelius Plantinga, who is a theologian at Calvin College, obviously a Reformed institution, has written the following. Although Christians of various theological orientations differ on central issues in the doctrine of original sin, for example, how a child acquires the fateful disposition to sin, whether this disposition is itself sin, how to describe and assess the accompanying bondage of the will, they agree on the universality, solidarity, stubbornness, and historical momentum of sin. Let me repeat that statement by Plantinga. He says, although Christians of various theological orientations, Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, differ on central issues in the doctrine of original sin. Nevertheless, they agree on the universality, solidarity, stubbornness, and historical momentum of sin. So that still leaves us with a robust doctrine of sin and human fallenness and universal need of salvation among all mankind. Now, as I mentioned, Orthodoxy does affirm, along with Catholicism and Protestantism, the historicity of Adam and Eve. So that although they don't have the doctrine of original sin, they do preserve the historical Adam. And if you give up on the historical Adam, I think that this would serve to destroy the typology of Adam with Christ. Paul calls Jesus Christ the second Adam, and he draws a parallel between the two. Adam is a type of Christ, a sort of figure or foreshadowing of Christ, who is called the second Adam. Just as through Adam, all persons fell into sin, so in Christ, redemption is made available for all persons. And if there is no historical Adam, then this typology of Adam and Christ would be destroyed. There would no longer be any historical parallel between Christ and Adam. And that, I think, is very troubling. Now, notice this would not mean that if Adam is a mythological figure, then Jesus of Nazareth was a mythological figure. That would be ridiculous. Saying that Adam didn't exist wouldn't in any way imply that Jesus of Nazareth didn't exist. On the contrary, in fact, it would be precisely the parallelism between Adam and Jesus that would be destroyed by denying the historical Adam. Now what you would have is a figurative or mythological figure on the one hand and an indisputably historical person on the other hand. So the parallelism between the two would be destroyed if we give up on the historical Adam. Even proponents of the modern view of the fall, who see the fall as simply symbolic of the fallenness of all mankind, admit that Paul, the apostle, at least believed that there was a historical Adam. When you read Romans 5, 1 Corinthians 15, it's evident that Paul at least thought that Adam was a historical person who was parallel to Jesus of Nazareth. More than that, however, Paul didn't simply believe that Adam was a historical person. He asserted and taught that he was a historical person. So you can't say that this was just a kind of incidental belief that Paul held. For example, if Paul thought that the sun goes around the earth, that would be a mistake, but it wouldn't be an error in Pauline theology because Paul didn't teach this, even if that's what he thought as a first century person. But in this case, he not only believed that Adam was a historical person, but he actually asserts it and he teaches it. Remember, we saw in Acts 17 that Paul says, from one man, God made every nation of men that they should inhabit the face of the whole earth. And so to deny the historical Adam would be to say that Paul is in theological error in thinking of Adam as a type of Christ. And that threatens to undo Pauline theology. You pull that thread and the whole fabric, I think, threatens to unravel. And therefore, it does seem to me that there is a lot at stake here and that therefore we should resist, if we can, claims that Adam and Eve were purely symbolic or mythological figures and not historical. And so, given the defensibility of Adam and Eve in light of contemporary population genetics and estimations of ancestral populations, I'm sticking with the historical Adam and Eve on the basis of Paul's teaching as well as the affirmations in the book of Genesis. Any discussion of the consequences of giving up on the historical Adam and how we might adjust to that? Okay, Taiwan.
The sin in contrasting the first Adam and second Adam basically is due to the eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So that basically means that if we embrace God's standard of good and evil, as Jesus does, then the sin will be redeemed. But if we do not hold on to God's standard of good and evil, we in turn interpret what is good, and basically we interpret what is good for me is good. So that changed the nature of good and evil in its standard, and that becomes sin. Yeah. It's from the God's standard to man's standard, and man's standard differs one from another.
Yes.
And so I believe in historical Adam, but even if it's symbolic, the fall is basically denying God's standard of good and evil.
I think that's right, Taewon. And I think for that reason, you don't need the historical fall in order to preserve the doctrine that all people are sinful, they have distorted and warped God's standards of righteousness, they have pursued finite goods like their own goods instead of God himself, the ultimate good. And that is, I think, the essence of sin. It's to no longer seek God as the ultimate good, but to seek lesser goods in the place of God. And so that doctrine, I don't think, is threatened by denying the historicity of Adam. I think you're right about that. I think that was Plantinga's point as well. Let me get someone who hasn't asked a question for a while. So we'll go to Bruce back here.
I was going to say, in regards to the original sin, we may not have inherited that specific sin, saying we would do the same thing in the same place. But what we inherit is the effects of the original sin, and that we don't have the personal one-on-one with God. And so we have a predisposition. We're born into a sinful world with that predisposition. And when we become accountable, we'll be sinners in our own right by nature and choice.
All right. Bruce is offering here a reinterpretation, if you will, of the doctrine of original sin that is one that I know some people hold today. And what he's saying is that it's not that you are culpable for Adam's sin. You can only be guilty and culpable for your own sins, not for somebody else's. But he's saying that there is a kind of corruption that is introduced through Adam's fall into the human race, so that we're all born with this inward disposition to sin. We're warped and selfish, and therefore no longer naturally pursue God's goodness. And that would be closer to the Eastern Orthodox view of sin, where we don't inherit the culpability and guilt of Adam, but simply this corruption. And we'll talk about that when we get to the doctrine of original sin, that this is a multifaceted doctrine. And so what Bruce has hit on here is just one facet of the doctrine. And I suppose the question would be, could you give up some of these other facets and retain that part of it? Yes, Drew, down here.
Thanks. It's not just the Eastern Orthodox Church that denies the Western view of original sin, but also there's Anabaptist traditions as well. If you read Kirk McGregor's A Molinist Anabaptist Systematic Theology, he goes through these doctrines of original sin.
And when was this written?
I don't know. It was fairly recently.
I see. Okay. So, but historically, have Anabaptists, I'm not familiar with Anabaptist doctrine. I think he believes so.
I haven't read enough Anabaptists to say for sure, but it looks like, Anabaptists generally historically have denied the sin nature.
I see.
In humanity.
The Protestant evangelical that I'm most familiar with who denied the doctrine of original sin is Finney, the 19th century theologian who is something of a maverick for having denied the doctrine of original sin as a Protestant and evangelical. But that would be interesting if there are parallels in Anabaptist traditions as well.
And if you want to read more about the Eastern Orthodox, probably the best author is John Romanides. John S. Romanides wrote an article, Original Sin According to St. Paul, where he goes through like Romans 5:12, saying, like as a native Greek speaker, the best interpretation is that of Romans 5:12 is that sin through Adam, sin came into the world, and through sin, death, and so death spread to all men, because of which all sin. That because of death, all sin, not the other way around. Uh-huh. So that was Romanides, and okay. It's a traditional.
And is this
Eastern
the correct
Orthodox
spelling view. Of his name?
Romanides. Yes.
Okay.
That's it. Thank
so
you.
So if anyone's interested in following up on that, good. Okay, Steve.
A couple things. I was taught the original fall was the angelic fall first, and another point is that humanity could be in a state. The fallen angels upon the earth at that time, but then God could create Adam in Mesopotamia, southern Mesopotamia, and create him as an adult and have him walk with him like Enoch, you know, and give him this charge to rule over the world.
Yes.
You know, and then Adam could fall and it'd be a new awareness of death when man chose to decide for himself what was right and wrong, must be his own God. And he would immediately have to darken his mind because of the condemnation. He'd be death wouldn't enter him as far as he would be running from God. It would be all the attributes God had given him to rule the world. He would be using to hide from God, to preserve his life, you know. And because we're all made of one blood, one flesh, it would be imparted to all people a new hiding, a new death.
A new what?
A new death throughout the world. Even though there was physical death before, this would be a spiritual death where it would be impossible to come back to God if we didn't have the sins lifted off.
Yeah, now, that's closer to the traditional doctrine of original sin. Remember when we talked about the fall and its consequences on the original view, falling from the state of integrity and innocence into the state of corruption and separation from God and the major and minor perfections that were lost. The emphasis on the angelic fall that Steve rightly points to is a characteristic emphasis, again, of orthodoxy, of Eastern Orthodoxy. They want to say that the origin of sin is through the satanic fall, and then it enters into the human race through Adam as the doorway, so to speak. But the real origin goes back further to this angelic fall. But there's no suggestion anywhere in Scripture that human beings are implicated in the angelic fall. We're not held guilty or corrupted by the angelic fall. It is through Adam that sin enters into the human race. And so when we're talking about the doctrine of the fall, that's why we focus on Adam's sin rather than this prior angelic fall.
Right. And what I was trying to point out is it could have been created, and there's a lot of Samaritan texts that support Adam being created. They talk about it, that he lived 900-something years where most people died early. There's a book, good book, Historical Genesis, and it supports everything in the Bible, I think, because the guy's a devout Christian that wrote it, my understanding. Okay. But another thing, just the first scripture we quoted in Philippians about Christ came to redeem. Every knee is going to bow. He's going to redeem everybody. Every knee is going to bow in heaven, on earth, and listen to this, under the earth. So he's going to get the fallen things, too. All right? So,
yeah, all right.
Wait, this is a doctrine. So here's how it applies to Adam. All right. Adam was created. Humanity existed, okay? And he was to form the family that Christ was going to come from. And the creation of Adam and the laws were to preserve the Adamic. But then when it was extended to the Christians, we were not part of that. Christ's grace is to cure our problem, which is our separation from God. Now, he's lifted off the guilt, and now you have access of his spirit again.
Okay.
And that is, as Colossians says, in whom we have the redemption. And then it says what it is, the lifting off of our sin.
All right. Now, let me just respond to this notion that through Christ, everything is going to be restored. This is the doctrine that Origen taught called apokatastasis. He was a Greek church father who believed that the redemption wrought in Christ was so powerful and so universal that not only all human beings would be redeemed, but that Satan himself and the demons would be redeemed, that everything would be restored ultimately through Christ. So this denies the doctrine of hell. It holds to universalism, not simply with respect to human beings, but even with regard to Satan and demons. And I think is very, very difficult to square with orthodoxy. And by that, I mean orthodoxy with a small o, with biblical teaching. And Origen was condemned for his views on this. So this is not a doctrine that I think we should embrace. Now, I see you waving your hand, Steve, but I do want to move on to someone else. So let's let James here have the
Bill, mic. I don't know if I can agree with what you said about, you said that the doctrine of original sin is not essential. I believe it is, because here's why.
Okay, go ahead.
Why would Christ have needed to die? If there would be no need for him to die on the cross. He could have just come and could have, through his act of obedience, could have imputed righteousness to us. There would have been no need for the removal of the sin. So I don't...
Well, now, James, I appreciate pushback on this, because I think those of us who are Catholic or traditional Protestants should push back and say, wait a minute, we're not going to easily give up this important doctrine. But having said that, if you think that Christ's death as a sacrificial offering to God is necessary to pay the penalty for sin, why can't it be the penalty for each person's own sin that drives Christ to the cross and requires atonement? Why does it have to be original sin that I am guilty of and need redemption from? That's just not clear to me.
Okay, because God had decided before he ever created that Christ was going to come to the earth and redeem mankind of from sin. I don't believe in a plan B. I don't believe he said, I made man, and he had to come in and here's sin, so I got to take care of it. So, Christ, you're going to have to do this. I believe that was decided before anything was ever created.
Yes, right.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it says from before the foundations
exactly.
of the world, he was slain,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that this was in the foreordination and plan mm-hmm. of God to deal with sin. But I guess my question would be, is doesn't all sin require some sort of sacrificial offering to appease the wrath and justice of God? And if that's true, then given the universality of sin and the stubbornness of sin, that we're all fallen, isn't that sufficient to require the cross? It's not clear to me that the cross, the need of the cross would be obviated if you give up the idea that I'm implicated in Adam's sin rather than for my own sins. So that would be my response. But this is, I agree with you, not a doctrine that we should easily abandon. And when we get to the doctrine of original sin, we'll flesh this out some more. We'll talk about it some more. But here we're just talking about the importance of the historical fall for Christian theology. All right. Is there any final question before we dismiss for today? Yes.
My question would be, do we still have a sinful nature? You know, when we were born, are we born with a sinful nature? And if there wasn't one specific instance, one specific time yeah. when sin entered, then were we designed by God to have a sinful nature?
This is really an excellent question. I mean, you heard Bruce's emphasis where he wanted to say, we do have this corrupted, sinful nature, even if we're not culpable for Adam's sin. Remember, I said you could hold that there's still a kind of corruption and disposition to sin that comes into humanity without saying you're culpable for what Adam did, that you got to pay the penalty for what he did. But nevertheless, I think that you're raising a good point. In what sense could we say that our very nature as human beings is corrupted and fallen just because there is sin prevalent among human beings? It would seem on this view that human nature wouldn't be fallen in that way. Rather, it would simply be that as every individual grows up to adolescence and adulthood in a culture that is permeated by sin, that he will naturally fall into sin himself. Rather than having this in his nature, it would be something that is more external to him and which corrupts him by growing up in a fallen society and culture. And that might make us feel uncomfortable. Maybe that's giving up too much of the doctrine of original sin to say merely that.
Well, would it then follow that while we as Christians who have, you know, who have accepted Christ still feel the temptation to sin, feel that disposition to sin, would it then follow that when we are born, we are born without sin? And
right,
you know,
that would follow that when a little baby is born, he is born without sin.
And we are not fallen until that first moment that we choose to sin?
That would seem to be the consequence of this view. Children would be innocent. Now that in one sense might be helpful because it could explain then the salvation of infants who die. They don't bear Adam's guilt. And so you don't need to baptize them. If they die in infancy, they go to heaven because they're not sinners. But on the other hand, here's the troubling implication I think that view has. That would mean that it's theoretically possible that somebody could grow up and never sin and therefore never have any need for redemption by Christ if he lives a sinless life. And that would seem to be possible on this view because he doesn't carry this fallen nature. And so given that sin isn't necessary, it's always a free act, sin isn't compulsory, it would seem to imply that a person could avoid the need of redemption by Christ and just go to heaven through his own merits. And that seems terribly wrong.
Yeah, and there are some verses that I can't bring to mind at the moment, the references, but I seem to remember verses in the New Testament where it talks about our sin nature and our fallen
yes.
sin nature and how we, you know, we are helpless.
Yes.
To the sin nature.
Yeah, that's
and
certainly
so
right. Paul talks about
the
old man, the natural man, the unregenerate man. So you're absolutely right, and those would need to be taken into account in trying to craft our doctrine of sin, and particularly original sin. So those are all very good points. But I think you can see that this exercise in exploring what is the worst case scenario. What happens if this doctrine of the historical Adam is abandoned? What happens? That's at least worth thinking about, because then we'll have a clear idea of the consequences of the denial of this doctrine and hence of the importance of this doctrine. So that's why we engaged in this little exercise. All right, next time we will turn then to the question of the nature of sin, wherein Does sin consist? What is sin? What is it to sin? Those will be the questions we explore next time.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.